Welcome to the Washington AI Network. I'm Tammy Haddad, the host of this podcast and the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together researchers, policymakers, industry, academicians, all of those who are working on AI. My special guest today is Rob Silvers. He's the Undersecretary for the Department of Homeland Security, covering strategy, policy, and plans. As most of you know, Rob is at the intersection of everything from Secret Service to cyber to presidents and every U.S. citizen's safety. Rob started in 2021 as Undersecretary of Policy. Rob is the chair of both the U.S. Cyber Safety Review Board and the Federal Forced Labor Enforcement Task Force. He also oversees the federal government's Supply Chain Resilience Center.
I'm so glad you're here today because this is such an incredible national moment with the release of Evan Gershovich and the 24 people that were released. I don't know if you guys follow just how many people are involved. So it's 7 countries, 24 people, 4 Americans. I know it's the State Department, not you guys, but I'd love for you to talk about it as a longtime public servant and trying to make the world a better place.
This is one of those special moments where you get an incredible outcome that protects and saves real American people. And we did it through diplomacy, through the network of relationships that we have built around the world that President Biden and Vice President Harris and their team have developed across building coalitions in Ukraine, building coalitions in the Indo-Pacific and the like. And what it shows is that when the chips are down, and you need something, you have friends that you can call on. And people like Evan and Paul Whelan and the Russian-American dissidents who were freed today with such drama on a hot tarmac in Ankara, it's a product of that. And what a sweet outcome for those Americans and their families. And there are so many reporters here tonight. I know this has really been a special cause for the journalism community. It's just a wonderful American result. Terrific.
Yeah, it is. So in the not happy side of the world where all these things are happening, I want to turn to the Middle East. Sorry to make such an abrupt turn, but so much has taken place. I'm not going to go into the details, but from an American perspective, what does it mean? The tensions are everywhere. People feel it here. How does that impact what you guys are doing?
This is a tense and volatile region generally, and we are at a very difficult place right now in that region. There's just no two ways about it. The horrific assault on Israel on October 7th and the conflict in Gaza since have really captured the attention of everyone around the world and been a very difficult, heartbreaking a set of circumstances. And now you have tensions on the northern border with Hezbollah in Lebanon, obviously the reports of a strike in Iran. So the administration is very closely tracking this. And from a homeland perspective, we're very mindful that when you have increased tensions, heightened emotions around delicate issues, people can be mobilized towards violence. And we are very conscious that we're in a heightened threat environment domestically. And we are pouring unprecedented levels of resources into ensuring that the American people are safe. We are funding state and local police departments. We are sharing threat information and intelligence with state and local police departments, also religious institutions that are very concerned for their own safety around the country. They know that they have a partner in our Department of Homeland Security that is looking out for them every single day and night. So while it's a very difficult time and we all have to stay quite vigilant, the American people also can rest assured that they have a lot of resources mobilized behind them for their protection.
How do you communicate that? Is it through the local law enforcement? How do you tell people, oh, don't be scared?
Through a variety of channels. Certainly, we speak with mayors and governors, with members of Congress, with state and local police departments, and then they can amplify the message. We've had a very robust presence in terms of engagement with campuses and academic communities, given tensions on campuses over recent months. And honestly, fora like this, when the leaders of this department go out and speak and are asked, what is happening and how do we know if we can feel safe? This is an opportunity for us to communicate to the American people all that we're doing. And it's quite a lot.
And then you follow up. Now I'm going to hit all the greatest hits, right? The Microsoft CrowdStrike and the whole idea that the world really is kind of put on hold because of what's going on. And somehow you have to reassure citizens that it's going to work out when it's actually private companies. It is an issue. We'll get into cyber and all of that. But what is the DHS's response to that? And how do you work together on that?
When we saw that outage about 2 weeks ago, it really was a very stark reminder of both the power of our internet infrastructure and technology and how much it does for us. Because when it gets disrupted, you realize how much we rely on it. We are very interdependent. We are very interconnected. And there is a fragility to it. It is so important that we be active in defending against potential threats, though in this particular instance, there's no indication that there was any malicious type of attack. It appears to have been an error by all accounts. And then also, critically, focused on recovery. It's all about resilience. Bad things are going to happen in our technology world, just like bad things are going to happen in our physical world. And you can try to prevent as many of the bad things from happening at all as possible. And a lot of the time, through work with a lot of the private sector partners that you just named, for example, we're heading off attacks that the American people never even hear about because it's been headed off. Some stuff is inevitably going to slip through. So what you need to do is to build the ability to recover quickly so that when you get hit, you can get back up to speed very, very quickly. And I think there's going to be some lessons learned as we all study this recent incident about what it takes for an organization to build back up quickly. That's just really, really important.
You're also chair of the Cyber Safety Review Board, and you guys released a report on the Microsoft Online Exchange hack from last summer. In the report, you called for them to upgrade their security. Can you tell us if that is happening? And do you feel like that was a message to the entire community that was heard?
The Cyber Safety Review Board, which is a relatively new institution that was formed 2 years ago, housed within the Department of Homeland Security, and I'm pleased to chair it. Half the members are all the public sector leads for cybersecurity, the head of cyber at the FBI, the head of cyber at the NSA and the like. And then half the members are private sector luminaries in cybersecurity. And we review really serious incidents and develop findings and recommended lessons learned so that everybody can improve going forward. In the review that you mentioned, we made a number of findings and recommendations directed towards Microsoft, which plays such a critical part in our technology ecosystem. We were direct about areas where we saw significant issues. Microsoft's response has been fantastic. The CEO of the company, Satya Nadella, came out on the issue and said, we need to do better. And he directed his employees to prioritize security above everything else. And he, in a move that I hadn't heard really any company doing before, tied senior executive compensation and bonuses to achievement of cybersecurity milestones. So it's all about culture and tone from the top in these kinds of issues. From any incident, if something will have had to go wrong, it's key to be able to acknowledge that and move forward and improve. That's all promising. And Microsoft has invited us to review the state of their improvements that they have underway. They've published an improvement plan, and that's a good step too. So march onward.
What about all the other companies? Was it a note heard around Amazon and everyone else that the government is looking at it more closely?
Let me tell you the best thing that I saw after the report and Microsoft's response. I was forwarded by someone an article in a human resources industry publication, and it noted the executive compensation point and said, is this the new normal? Is this now the new standard that other companies need to follow? And I love that because that's what lessons learned means. It's about seeing things, making improvements, and then having that spread. And absolutely, I think companies across the spectrum have seen the work of the Cyber Safety Review Board, including the review of the Microsoft incident, and have taken note that it needs to be a high priority issue, including in the boardroom and the C-suite.
I want to go to AI, but I have to ask you about the Secret Service. It's almost 3 weeks since the assassination attempt. Is there anything new that you can let us know?
We take incredibly seriously the events in Butler, Pennsylvania, and the absolutely horrific attempt on the life of former President Trump. It is our highest priority to achieve our mission at the Secret Service of protecting our national leaders. Obviously, something went very wrong that day, and we are committed to finding out all the lessons learned and to making whatever improvements are necessary. And that is why Secretary Mayorkas very promptly announced the creation of an independent review panel of very distinguished former security and law enforcement leaders to come in, gather facts, and make recommendations to him if anything needs to change, because we are committed to doing whatever is needed. I don't want to be lost in all this, the incredible heroism of the women and men of the United States Secret Service. They are the finest protection force in the world, full stop. And you saw that on the stage that horrific early evening with the way that those agents and officers responded. Obviously, a very difficult set of circumstances here, but we are committed to developing the lessons learned and to taking whatever action is needed.
We always hear doom and gloom on AI and how things have changed. I would like to ask you how AI has made your job and protecting the country better.
You want to hear a great story?
Yeah. I'm all about the great story.
Every day, we have tens and tens of thousands of cars coming across our land borders from Mexico and Canada. And it's critical. That's cross-border communities. People go to school and jobs on both sides. People shop. It's huge. It's critical for business. It's an overwhelming amount of traffic. It's almost hard to wrap your head around how much traffic it is. Fentanyl, which is poisoning upwards of 70,000 Americans per year in overdose deaths, a salt shaker worth can kill a person. And you can imagine how hard it is to detect. Historically, customs officers at the border would have to get a quick read on the vehicle coming through, do their best in deciding which ones to call aside for further inspection. We are using machine learning models now that can analyze factors, including a vehicle's travel history, to look for anomalies, to look for things that seem suspicious. And we recently, I believe in San Diego, had that machine learning model trigger on a vehicle that otherwise looked entirely routine. The officer, based on that hit, which came in 1.4 seconds, referred the vehicle for a secondary inspection, and we found 75 kilos of narcotics. That is just one microcosm, one anecdote of how AI can change the game for the security of the American people. And we're not stopping there. We're using it to see how we can enhance the passenger screening experience at airports with TSA, go faster and have it be more accurate, and on and on and on. The possibilities are so fantastic. And there are also very serious risks that need to be identified and addressed head on and mitigated. I'm glad you asked about the opportunities, because the opportunities are just transformative and amazing, including in our world.
Do you have a department of AI that focuses just on that? Do companies come and pitch their products? It feels like all of this is happening in real time. And if you're DHS, you're kind of like the mothership, you and the Pentagon. If I had any great technology, I'd be pitching you right now, I got to be honest. But it's coming in all these different kinds of places. And again, companies first. So how do you even analyze what is useful, where it goes? Do you have a list of places we could use the most help, like at the border, or do people just come to you?
To your question, do we have an office or a division that thinks about AI? We have an incredible chief AI officer named Eric Heisen. He's also the CIO of the Department of Homeland Security. And he has been an absolute wizard in identifying opportunities where AI can help us do better to protect the American people, like the ones that I just described. But I think if Eric were here, what he would tell you and what he would pride himself on is that it's very organic and coming from the bottom up. Nobody at our headquarters knows the business as well as the operators who are on the ground, screening cargo, screening cars, looking for fentanyl, looking for terrorist threats, and the like. Those teams have their own great ideas. Our job then is to help them, get them the budget, get them the approvals, clear through the red tape so that they can get the incredible technology working for them. So it's very bidirectional. We have ideas, they have ideas. It's definitely not a top-down approach at all. Yes, of course, we get regularly approached by technology providers who have incredible solutions. Our door is open to listen and learn. This is an area where we have to be humble about what we understand. This technology did not originate with the federal government, and it's changing so rapidly that we have to hear closely from industry, and we always do.
When did you first hear about ChatGPT? Did you know about it first? Before it came out publicly?
I don't remember the moment, but I do remember it was still then called Twitter. I just remember on Twitter, suddenly, like my tech Twitter people, that was probably you people. I just remember a number of comments that were like, whoa. I said, I need to check this out. And I downloaded it, started playing around. One of the very first things I did, I brought my then 10 and 6-year-old to the screen with me, and we decided to write goofy stories together, and they would do the prompts. And it was just amazing to me the range of research-driven answers to sophisticated questions in beautiful prose. You could also get a totally goofy thing that made my 6-year-old belly laugh. That was a wonderful few days to realize the power of all that.
And then you got nervous, right? Then you're like, I have to deal with it. We should talk about disinformation, by the way, because that is the biggest issue in the election and, frankly, in how everyone lives their lives every day. What do you think so far, because this is a couple years in, has been the one way that you're able to make a difference? Don't say communication. I'm sorry, everyone says communicate more. And I do think that's true. But what do you think has made a difference?
What's made a difference is where we, in our work, are able to put out factual information about what's really going on in a way that people can look to and trust. So, for example, sometimes after a natural disaster, like a hurricane or a tornado, people are out of their homes. They may just have whatever they could grab with them. They're entitled to federal relief funding from FEMA, right, from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which, side note, is just an incredible organization. But we have sometimes seen that these scams emerge with people trying to prey on the victims and say, give us your information or what have you to get a relief check. Or that there's just rumor, there's just stuff flying around, and it might be well-intentioned, but people are just putting wrong information out there about how to apply and be eligible for the relief that you can get in those terrible circumstances. To be able to gain visibility to those narratives that are going on, that are pushing people in the wrong direction about something like that, and then put out almost in a myth reality format, look, here's how you do it. Here's how you do it from the FEMA.gov website so you know you can trust it. That is what we found a very powerful antidote. I am not going to sugarcoat this. This is a hell of a problem, and we have not figured out all the correct solutions to that problem. Some of the solutions may well lie with our federal government. Some of the solutions don't. In a world where we have a First Amendment, for example, that we have to honor. This is a hard issue where we've made some inroads, but it is very much among the more challenging issues that we face.
AI threats are worse than cyber threats, harder.
If you really want to go, you know, Sharknado on it, you have some AI-enabled cyber threats. AI is going to make cyber attackers more powerful. because they can automate their attacks and have generative AI write very compelling and persuasive and tricky messages. It's also going to enable and empower cyber defenders who can look for anomalies across all that data at a way that human speed could never match. All that's theoretical and true. In the wild, based on what we actually are seeing out there, I would say we have seen more instances of cyber defenders being able to use the technology to good effect than we have cyber attackers actually launch exotic, unheard of kinds of new attacks using AI. OpenAI and Microsoft several months ago put out a report together about some instances in which they saw nation state hackers using AI. I believe they were using ChatGPT specifically. But it was interesting because they were using ChatGPT to make their life a little easier in the way that many of us do, to get a little more efficient, debug some code, write a little bit of a text instead of writing it all out yourself. They weren't orchestrating whole new waves of attacks with it. And at this point, network defenders are using it successfully every day. And I'd say if you had to say who's in the lead and who's helping, it's defenders. But that could change. And I think it's going to be checkered. I think you're going to see successes on both sides as this goes on.
Do you worry about OpenAI? Social media companies are not really jumping in on misinformation, disinformation in the elections. But OpenAI raised their hands and said, you know what? We're going to help. Someone uses our AI. We're going to take them down. Does that help you or does that work against you? This private company has raised their hand and said, okay, we're going to protect you all. Because that's really what they're saying. We're the guys. Look to us. That makes me nervous that a private operation is doing that versus government. And then it makes me worry that are people going to trust DHS when you say something else? Or there's variety reports about OpenAI, questions about some of their practices. There was a hack that they didn't tell anyone about.
It's not our job. We don't have the legal authority to command tech platforms what kind of content they can or cannot let on their platforms, with a couple little exceptions. It's illegal to have child pornography, for example. But when you're talking about political views, speech, even false speech, we cannot and we do not tell companies what to do. Companies make their own decisions. And we see some companies that are quite laissez-faire about it, even some platforms that sort of pride themselves on that. And we've seen some platforms that feel a sense of responsibility to maintain certain kinds of content moderation for their community. Personally, I think the idea of an internet where just anything goes that kids are exposed to is a troubling thing. As a dad of two, it's troubling to me.
Do you let them use AI, by the way, without you?
No. Well, I guess I do because there's an Alexa in the house. I don't even think about it that way, to be honest. But yes, there's parenting discussions you can have about it, but this is where we are. I think it's going to very soon become the exception that there's an 11-year-old that does not have a touch point regularly with AI because it's going to be everywhere. And those who succeed as people, as organizations, are going to be the ones that ride that and accept it and get good at it and also get responsible about it. And that's for kids. It's for parents too.
Let's talk about China. And then I want to talk about the work you're doing on the Uyghurs. But let's talk about China first and the China threat.
China is a generational challenge to this country. It is presenting itself in so many forms, on so many levels. Obviously, the traditional defense and intelligence levels around Taiwan and the South China Sea, spying, including hacking for spying and all those things. Increasingly, we see China trying to exert its will into the United States or other Western democracies, intimidating university and diaspora communities into feeling like they can't express certain viewpoints or their relatives back in China may be punished for it. There's obviously human rights and values issues that are so clearly important to who we are and where we have to stand up. We've been talking about technology risk here in various flavors. And when it comes to AI, China's in the race. They're in the race. I'm happy to say that at this moment, I think the United States is ahead of China, but it's not a foregone conclusion that we always will be. You ask some experts in the field, some of them think we're like 4 months ahead. And whichever country has the strongest AI ecosystem is going to reap so many dividends. Soft power, hard power, diplomatic power, healthcare, you name it, not to mention huge economic dividends, it goes without saying.
Can you talk about what you're doing, the forced labor with the Uyghurs? Because I think it's an amazing American story.
It is. Many in this room probably know of the human rights atrocities that happen, particularly in Xinjiang province of China, and the repressed Uyghur minorities there, that China is trying to erase their identity. And it is illegal in this country to bring products made with forced labor into the United States. That's been the law for a century or so. Our department is on the front lines of making sure that products made with forced labor by Uyghurs in Xinjiang province are not allowed to come into this country so that China cannot profit from that and to compel China to change its activity. And our enforcement has been so strong that we are seeing supply chains start to shift. We are seeing companies, the big U.S. retailers and importers, start to do really deep diligence into who are they buying from, and then who are those people buying from, and then who's the tier four supplier and the tier eight supplier, all the way down. And it is changing trade for the benefit of human rights. And tomorrow, I will be traveling actually to a factory in Michigan that makes polysilicon. Polysilicon used to be made almost exclusively in China, and a lot of it in Xinjiang province under terrible conditions. Now, because of our enforcement, there's a factory in Michigan that can't expand fast enough because all the customers want to buy clean polysilicon. So we are making a real difference, and it honors human rights. And it also honors American workers and businesses that shouldn't have to compete against those kind and be undercut by those kinds of abuses.
Have you traveled to China? Have you met with them?
I have. I was in China in January in a series of discussions about the fentanyl epidemic.
Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions on AI. Anyone have a question? Can you please stand up and say your name?
Hi, Courtney Legg, Information Technology Industry Council. More about the AI safety and security the board that you guys stood up. I know that in addition to the executive order directive, where CISA produced the critical infrastructure guidelines, there's definitely some work going on with the board to bring those up to the C-suite level. If you could talk a little bit more about how you guys are thinking about that and what the ultimate objective is.
AI is so emergent that our Secretary Mayorkas believed that the only way to get to the correct approaches and solutions when it comes to AI safety and security are to not just consult with the private sector, but actually be shoulder to shoulder with the private sector in a lot of the work. And not just industry, but also the civil liberties groups, also the state and local officials, where so much of the action is. And the AI Safety and Security Board that we established in President Biden's executive order late last year, the membership, when Secretary Mayorkas chairs it, is really an incredible cross-section of all the leaders, all the stakeholders that are shaping this AI ecosystem, from the CEOs of the biggest technologies companies in the world to the leaders of leading U.S. civil rights organizations, Governor Wes Moore from Maryland, Mayor Harrell from Seattle, and the CEOs of too many multi-hundred-billion-dollar companies to even name without leaving some of them off. It's an incredible group. And what we're going to be doing with the board is really getting consensus and aligning around what should be the standards that adopters of AI and developers of AI employ to make sure that the technology can be enjoyed and used productively, but also safely, securely, and responsibly.
Hi, Liz Johnson with Senator Romney. I just wanted to talk, since we're in a season of political change, and we obviously have had a framework put forth in the Senate by the AI Working Group, unlikely to get much, if any, action before the end of the year. Are there some specific things that you would like to see from whatever the incoming administration is and from Congress, things that you think we can act more quickly on versus
the long process that it's going to take to come up with an actual regulatory framework? What are the, sort of the things that you would love to see happen out of the gate next year?
The most urgent priority is to gather data points. I think we need to be really humble about how much we actually understand about the technology, and humble about the fact that inevitably there's going to be some regulation around AI. It is inevitable. It is going to happen. It's already happening in Europe. It's going to happen here in some shape or form, some combination of state and local and federal actors. It's going to happen. And some should. But it takes a long time to change a statute or a regulation once you issue it, longer than most people realize. And it goes back to the China point. We are so neck and neck with China in the AI race. If we could exit with the best, purest intentions, we could really slow ourselves down if we make the wrong moves. We need to collect a lot of data about how this technology actually is being used and how are people actually being hurt or harmed by it to inform our decisions. I just think that is the most urgent priority right now.
I'm Pamela Brown with CNN. You talk about the AI race with China, and you think right now, as it stands, that the U.S. is ahead. I know it varies in terms of how much, depending on who you ask. But what are you measuring that by? Like, how do you measure where we are compared to China?
It's such a great question. We don't have a standard set of metrics that we have a dashboard every morning that shows where we are and where they are. What we really do is we collect views from those in the industry that are measuring the power and the capability of their most advanced models and comparing it with the most advanced models that are coming out of China. There's probably a degree of it that is anecdotal versus strictly data-driven, and that's why you get a range of estimates. But when you hear those kinds of estimates from enough computer scientists that are the ones that are actually training and developing these models, and when they all seem to sync with each other, that's something we take pretty seriously and that we credit.
Hi, Maddie Golden with Nick Rasmussen. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the work you're doing and the partnerships you're exploring in augmented and virtual reality.
The volume of child pornography online is a truly sickening, revolting thing. I don't think most people realize or care to think about the massive extent of the problem. And there is huge promise in artificial intelligence technology to detect and take down that kind of content. And many of the leading tech platforms in the United States have done a lot of really, really innovative work to protect their platforms and the American people from that. We are also in discussions with some of the technology companies about pilots that we can run together, perhaps, to better understand how AI can either manufacture those kinds of images or detect and take them down. So it's something we're very focused on.
That's terrific. Rob, thank you so much for your time today. Let's hear it for him. Thank you for answering all the questions.
Thank you so much.
Much appreciated. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.